Thank you, Judge Baker. We're now ready to begin with our first case of the term, United States against Pena. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Chief Judge Efron, members of the court, good morning. I'm Captain Vicki Ballou, and together along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellant in this case, Senior Airman Timothy J. Pena. The essential question in this case is whether the Air Force Clemency and Parole Board, without any congressional authorization and without due process, impermissibly imposed upon Senior Airman Pena mandatory supervised release and its conditions. We respectfully submit that the answer to this question is yes, for the following reasons. There's no legal authority for mandatory supervised release, MSR. By imposing mandatory supervised release, the Air Force Clemency and Parole Board increased the severity of Senior Airman Pena's sentence. And third, the Air Force Clemency and Parole Board's conditions and their imposition violated the Due Process Clause and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. On September 3rd of 2002, Airman Pena was convicted of offenses involving indecent assaults. He was sentenced to a dishonorable discharge, 1 year confinement, and reduction to E1. He spent his confinement at the Naval Consolidated Brig at Miramar, and while he was there, he earned the maximum good conduct time credit. He applied for parole but was denied parole. He was informed of this denial by Mr. Greg Newbold, who told him that the Air Force Clemency and Parole Board denied his parole and simultaneously ordered him to participate in the mandatory supervised release program. On the 22nd of June 2003, he was involuntarily imposed mandatory supervised release and its conditions. He served those conditions until the 2nd of September 2003. There's no legal authority for mandatory supervised release.
Can I ask a question? You indicated in your opening spiel there that the MSR increased the severity of the sentence. And the government, in its brief, says the conditions did not extend his sentence to confinement, nor did they pose additional sentencing terms. So what is it precisely about the MSR that increased the severity of his sentence?
Yes, Your Honor, it did increase his sentence because he had a legitimate interest in his... He had a liberty interest in his good time credit that he earned. And based on that good time credit, his minimum release date, the date that he should have been out of confinement without any conditions, was the 22nd of June, 2003. So by imposing involuntarily mandatory supervised release conditions, those conditions increased his sentence because he had this liberty interest in his good time credit, and he earned his credit. There was no problems with in confinement, so his sentence was complete on the 22nd of June 2003.
So the issue for you is the good time credit?
Yes, sir, that's part of the issue.
And what else then increased the severity of the sentence if that's not the sole aspect of that issue?
The condition, what else increased his severity of his sentence were the conditions that were imposed upon him. Some of the conditions that were imposed upon him were conditions that could not even have been imposed upon him while he was in confinement. They went beyond their authority. Now, making him waive his right to self-incrimination. He had to waive his Article 31 rights. And by waiving those conditions, or waiving his Article 31 rights, his rights that are given to him, they could not impose those conditions upon him while he was in confinement, nor can they impose those conditions upon him outside of confinement.
What about the 24 months of sexual offender treatment?
The 24 months of sexual offender treatment, increased his sentence because, one, he was supposed to pay for it. He had to spend time and travel time and going to the sex offender treatment program.
Did the appellant, does the record reflect whether the appellant, in fact, attended 24 months?
No, the record does not reflect that.
So for all we know and all the record reflects, he attended until September?
Correct, Your Honor. Since we do not have a record, and that is one of the problems, is that there is no record that he can appeal on. There's no due process because the mandatory supervised release was imposed upon him. It was ordered without any chance to appeal it, without any chance to object to it. So we have no record to go by in regards to the mandatory supervised release.
He couldn't have filed an affidavit saying that he had attended for 22 extra months?
Yes, Your Honor, he could have filed an affidavit. However, what we have is the record and the fact that they did not provide any due process for him to object to the mandatory supervised release and its conditions.
Counsel, it seems to me that your argument may not be based upon the good time credit. As I understand the program, if they apply the good time credit, they're then released upon their minimum release date. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so under this program, they apparently applied the good time credit and he was released upon his minimum release date. However, the program that you're complaining of imposed conditions upon that period. Is that right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, the program did impose conditions upon him. However, with the good time credit, he had a liberty interest in being released on the 22nd of June. The good time credit has nothing to do with the mandatory supervised release.
He was released on the 22nd of June.
Released without any conditions.
Now, and where do you get released without any conditions? Where does that come from?
Because the good time credit, within their regulations, they have the right and authority to have a good time credit, good time conduct credit regulation scheme. And within that, that's in order to control the behavior within the prison. That's the behavior within the military confinement facilities. So there is nothing in the regulations that state that the good time credit is connected with mandatory supervised release.
Now, is there anything in the good time credit regulation that says that the prison cannot impose conditions once they're released on their minimum release date? Is there anything that prohibits that? They're still under some type of supervision.
It goes, Your Honor, there is nothing that specifically states that they cannot, within their regulations, impose conditions outside of confinement. However, involuntarily outside of confinement. However, they have no authority to impose conditions outside of confinement. Their authority comes from Title 10, Chapter 48, Military Confinement Facilities. That authority is to regulate the confinement facilities within the prison walls, to regulate within the prison walls. The only part of that statute that garners them authority to regulate outside or to, in essence, create a system of parole outside of confinement is that actual section, Section 952, which allows the secretary's concern to create a system of parole. Now, parole is voluntary. Mandatory supervised release is involuntary, and that is the distinction. They do not, based on that section of the statute, have any authority to impose involuntarily any conditions outside of confinement. Parole, by definition, is a voluntary agreement. The prisoners, they volunteer to apply for parole. They do not have an inherent right for parole. And they agree. It's a voluntary agreement for the prisoners to participate in parole. And those conditions that are placed upon them are conditions that they voluntarily agree to. The conditions in mandatory supervised release are not conditions that are voluntary. They are involuntary conditions.
Counsel, in the discussion of the liberty interest, you mentioned the liberty interest and the good time credits. Suppose we had a situation not involving mandatory supervised release in which an individual has earned good time credits and the confinement facility does not release the individual. What case in our court suggests that our court has authority to review the good time credit situation and determine whether or not the person should be released from confinement?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case within this court. However, the Supreme Court has found where a state grants, where a state regulation allows for good time credit, that based on a state statute that they have good time credit, that creates a liberty interest in good time credit.
Well, in our jurisprudence regarding the Eighth Amendment and Article 55, we've essentially drawn a line that said if the treatment of an individual in prison has the effect of increasing the punishment by imposing one of the prohibited punishments under Article 55 or under the Eighth Amendment, then the individual can seek relief from this court. But if the individual is complaining generally about the treatment in prison, in confinement, and the manner in which the prison facilities are administering that confinement, then they have to go to a federal district court. So why does not this individual have to go to a federal district court for those matters which do not increase the punishment? And let me add one other thing. You started off your argument by saying the critical question for in this case is whether the MSR program is authorized and whether it's been properly administered. Let's posit that it hasn't been authorized and it hasn't been properly administered. If it has not increased the punishment, what authority does this court have to take any action with regard to the administration of good time credits or any other aspect of the program?
If, Your Honor, if it had not increased the punishment, this court still has authority based on the fact that they violated the due process clause by not granting him his good time credit. That based on the regulation, the way that the regulation is set up to grant him good time credit for an early release, specifically in Enclosure 7 of the regulation, it calculates their confinement time prior to including what their possible good time credit could be. So he has a legitimate interest, a liberty interest within that good time credit.
If the confinement facilities violate the First Amendment by not allowing the individual to have certain reading materials or allegedly violate it, but that does not involve an increase in punishment, does this court have authority to regulate what goes on in the prison in terms of a judicial aspect, or is that authority lie with a federal district court?
This court does not have authority to, unless it's an increase of the sentence, this court does not have authority to regulate what goes on within the prison.
Well, was his sentence increased beyond 1 year, putting aside the question of the 24 months? I understand your argument on that. But in terms of the good time credit, was his sentence increased by the action or failure to act on the good time credit?
His sentence was not increased beyond, he was sentenced to confinement for 1 year. He was granted a liberty interest in the good time credit. So that that reduced his confinement term. Now, this is not a case where there's abuse in confinement. This is not a complaint about the execution of the sentence. It's because they changed the sentence. They increased
his sentence is 1 year, and even if he's let out early on good time credits, is not his sentence still 1 year?
His adjudged sentence is still 1 year. However, he still has a liberty interest within the good time credit. The confinement facility, the prisons, the Department of Defense created this liberty interest and good time credit, and it cannot be arbitrarily taken away. They are going well beyond their authority of regulating the confinement facilities and regulating conditions outside of confinement that they do not have authority to do. And by regulating these conditions, and let me rephrase that, they kept the sentence to 1 year by maintaining it to the 3rd or 2nd of September, which would have been the year of his confinement. And within that, they increased his sentence by imposing these conditions that took away liberty interests and took away, made him, created financial hardships upon him and made him do, essentially ordered him to do duties where they did not pay him to do these duties and put him on excess appellate leave.
How much pay did he receive while he was in confinement?
He did not receive any pay while he was in confinement.
So he received no pay while he was in confinement, and he received no pay after confinement. So how was his sentence increased?
Because the good time credit that he had a liberty interest in, he should have been released upon the 22nd of June, 2003. So by that, he should have been released without any conditions based on what the regulations and where they have the authority to create these regulations. Based on that, he should have been released on the 22nd of June, 2003.
And what would happen to him at that point if he were released on that day? Would he be put on active duty in a full pay status?
No, sir. His confinement would have been complete upon that date.
And so, if he wouldn't have been entitled to pay under the manner in which you suggest he should have been treated, why does he become entitled to pay under your argument about the MSR program?
Because, Your Honor, he is entitled to pay upon the MSR program, although, because they are ordering him to fulfill conditions. And to fulfill these conditions, they are creating a financial hardship upon him and upon his family. And he has to spend time to go to these classes. He has to spend time to go to conditions that aren't even based. The mandatory supervised release is based upon his offenses, and that's exactly what it's based upon. It is not based upon anything that has happened within the prison confinement, within the confinement facilities. So they are creating these conditions that are forcing him to attend classes, because if he fails to attend or fulfill the conditions, they have threatened him with action.
Okay, specifically in the record, what is in the record to show that his punishment was increased? The question was asked before about the 24 months of requirement to participate in a sexual offender program, but the record does not establish that he had 1 day of activity in that program after he was after he completed his period of service.
Your Honor, yes, the record does not establish that he attended beyond the 2nd of September, 2003.
So whose burden is it in this appellate litigation to establish the record as to whether he was punished beyond that September 2nd date?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it would be the appellant's burden to show beyond the 2nd of September, 2003. However, we do not have to show beyond the 2nd of September, 2003, because his confinement Well, his sentence was increased. The severity of his sentence was increased because they grant the prison, or because the regulation granted him a liberty interest in his good time credit, which he should have been released on the 22nd of June 2003. And the conditions that were imposed upon him, those conditions created the severity in his sentence. By imposing these conditions upon him involuntarily, making him attend these classes during the 73 days to attend AA three nights a week, because they do not have any authority to control outside of the confinement facility. Now, granted, this is... they do not have a penological legitimate interest to control outside of the prison facilities. Although it may be...
Counsel, you're heading into a different argument now. If I could just interrupt for a second to make sure I understand precisely what we're talking about here. And that is, my understanding based on this discussion we've had is that the court should focus only on the 73 days between 22nd of June and September 2nd. After September 2nd, we have nothing in the record to show that his punishment was increased beyond that date. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, you are correct. The focus should be only on those 73 days because those are the days that his sentence, the imposition of the MSR, was where his sentence was increased without any authority, without any due process. And based on the attending of Alcoholics Anonymous, when there was no evidence of any alcohol abuse, no evidence of any substance abuse, to have urine samples taken, when there's no evidence of any narcotics abuse, no evidence of any of that. And these conditions were vague and they violate the Constitution.
Counsel, if he had been in prison at that time, could he have come to this court and say, my punishment's been increased because they make me give urine samples and they've made me attend AA sessions while I'm in prison?
If he was in prison, it's because they have the authority to regulate the behavior within prison, they could impose certain conditions upon him. However, they could not force him to waive his confidentiality or force him to waive his Article 31 rights or his rights against self-incrimination while he's in prison.
In what circumstances does the record show that he was, in fact, forced to waive anything in that regard? I understand the requirements that were imposed upon him, but as in actual practice, on what circumstances did he waive those rights?
In Senior Evan Pena's declaration, he specifically states that he attended Alcoholics Anonymous. He also for three times a week, and it took him an hour for each time and an hour and a half for travel. And then he also attended the sex offender treatment, where he was required to participate within the sex offender treatment. And he periodically had to go to appointments with a psychiatrist, which also included his wife attending these appointments. So he clearly had to waive his rights by attending these appointments and participating within these treatment programs.
Would you agree that during these 72 days or 73 days, he's still under some degree of state supervision? And that there is some interest in protecting the community by requiring additional treatment programs that under a parole and probation program would be normal?
Your Honor, yes, I agree that there is a legitimate interest in protecting society. However, that interest is for Congress to make and for Congress to create authority for. It is not for a bureaucrat to regulate and to impermissibly impose upon someone. Yes, there is parole. However, within the military, parole is an agreement. It's It's a voluntary agreement. And even the president's position in the manual defines what parole is within the military. A violation of parole under Article 134 defines parole. And it defines parole as word of honor, an agreement between the parolee. The specific definition is a prisoner or parolee has agreed to adhere to a parole plan and conditions of parole. A parole plan is a written and oral agreement. Parole and mandatory supervised release are completely different.
So does your argument boil down to the fact that since this is an executive-created program without congressional authority, it is a nullity? They have acted beyond their authority.
Correct, Your Honor, because they have no authority to involuntarily impose this program, involuntarily impose the mandatory supervised release conditions upon Senior Airman Pena to take away his liberty interests, to impose these conditions upon him without any due process of law.
Without prejudice to your argument regarding this court's jurisdiction, is there any reason to believe that a federal district court would not have jurisdiction over your claim?
Yes, Your Honor. The federal district court would not have jurisdiction over the claim because this increases his sentence. This is something that within the military he would have no right to complain to a federal district court. Now, this does increase his sentence, and this is...
Counsel, I think your time's expired now, and if you'd like to address it further during rebuttal, you're welcome to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the government.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Jefferson E. McBride, and together with Colonel Gerald R. Bruce, we represent the United States government in this matter. Now, we intend to address each issue in turn, but the underlying threshold question that must be addressed first is whether or not this court has jurisdiction, or if it does, to what extent does it have jurisdiction. Now, while Appellant has attempted to phrase his arguments in such a way as to avoid coming right out and saying it, what Appellant wishes this court to do is find the MSR program illegal, and the processes and procedures as set out in that instruction and executed by the Air Force Clemency and Parole Board as unfair. Bottom line is that the MSR program is not punishment, but simply an administrative action taken by a separate executive military agency.
It's not punishment per se, so the MSR could, doesn't matter what they do, they could do anything. They could direct branding, they could have persons stay within the Leavenworth for an additional 5 years as part of the supervised release program.
I guess I wouldn't say...
I'm just trying to test your statement whether MSR per se or depends what they do.
But I would not say that per se it is not punishment, but just the MSR program in general, without looking at whatever conditions were put upon the individual ultimately, is not punishment in and of itself.
So is the government contesting the authority of this court to look at those specific conditions and determine whether they are or are not an increase in, resulting in an increase in punishment?
Well, what the government really is saying is that this court doesn't have a jurisdiction to look at the administration and the process and procedures with which the MSR program functions and is delegated down to the Air Force Clemency and Parole Board and those issues.
Well, wait, and that seems to undercut what you just told me. So if they do, if the MSR board says, okay, as part of your MSR, you have to live at Leavenworth for another 5 years, you're saying we don't have authority, jurisdiction to look at that. Do we or don't we? That hypothetical.
Well, I guess that's the question here, but I think the Air Force Court got it right, in which they said we can look at the MSR program generally to look to see if it increased the sentence, for example. But as to the administration of the MSR, like whether or not they were properly put on appellate leave or excess leave, those kinds of things, I think, fall outside the scope.
I see your distinction. Thank you.
Because it is a collateral issue involving an executive agency and not part of the findings or sentence.
Counsel, let me go back for a minute here before you leave that area. You just said that this court would have jurisdiction to look to see whether or not the sentence was increased. And I think in White, what we said was we had the authority to look to see whether the sentence violated Article 55 or the Eighth Amendment. Are you limiting that statement to whether or not there was a violation of Article 55 or the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, or any time a sentence is increased, even if it doesn't violate those two provisions, would this court have jurisdiction?
Well, under White, it's our position that yes, you're looking at, and I think the two almost go hand in hand to some extent, that whether a violation of Article 55 or the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, those kinds of things, I think, is what this court can look at generally under.
So if a action of a parole board or prison authorities increase the severity of a sentence, but not in a manner that violated Article 55 or the Eighth Amendment, this court would not have jurisdiction. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if an individual is sentenced to 1 year confinement, and after completing 360 days, they get a letter that says, congratulations, we're letting you out for the next 5 days as part of the MSR program. And as part of the requirement for that, you need to be in a halfway house for the next 3 years, in which you will be restricted to that house during all but 5 hours a day. We'd have no jurisdiction to look at that, even if it didn't violate the Eighth Amendment, in terms of whether it increased the punishment or not?
Well, I'd say arguably that that is a cruel and unusual punishment, which I guess mixing the terms together does increase the sentence.
In what case would continued confinement outside the prison walls, but in a halfway house, not constitute something that this court could look at if it went beyond the time of the adjudged sentence?
And what scenario would this court not be able to look at?
Yeah, if an individual has a sentence to 1 year, and after a year, as a result of this program, they find that their liberty interests are severely constrained, that is, they can only leave this halfway house, let's say, to go to a job 8 hours a day, and they got to come right back, and that's the way they have to live for some period of time.
If a condition was imposed upon the individual that fell outside, for example, the one-year time frame of confinement, that I think in that case, those conditions would be, this court would be able to look at and determine, is that did this in fact increase the sentence?
Well, what about in this case then, where they, on the face of it, they've said you need to go to this treatment program for 24 months, even though a sentence only ran for an additional 73 days, and you're going to have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Or you may have to, and I guess the way in this case that worked, the record reflects that the state paid for it, but on its face, the agreement in the MSR program seemed to imply that he needs to go to that for 24 months and he has to pay for it. Is that a valid requirement that does not offend our jurisprudence, does not extend the sentence beyond his 1 year?
Well, no, I don't think so in this case. I think the record is devoid of any action taken by the confinement facility or the probation officer.
I agree with that. Let's make it a hypothetical.
Okay.
Let's just say that that's what it says and that's what happened. that he was required to go to for 24 months. He went for 24 months, and he paid for it out of his own pocket.
Well, I think after the period of confinement, or at the period of his sentence, that if he went to this extra program, that depending on the actions of the probation officer, for example, whether it's pulling him back in or admonishing him in some way, then I think that would certainly be a scenario where that would be problematic.
So the government doesn't have any authority to impose conditions after his maximum release date?
Well, beyond that, it generally that the military would have control of the individual, because until the sentence is actually executed, the military still has reins on him. So I guess to that extent, then if his commander wanted him to go or whatever kind of scenario would come up in that regard, that would be fair game.
Let me ask you one other question here. This is a mandatory program. I think everybody agrees with that. And if we take a look at the Certificate of Mandatory Supervised Release, and if we look at I think it's the third page, where it talks about excess leave, and there's a statement there under subsection A where it says, I voluntarily apply for excess leave without paying allowances. Doesn't that seem a little inconsistent? We have a mandatory program that he's told that if he doesn't enter into it, he's subjecting himself to possible court-martial or disciplinary board, and in there he's saying, oh, but by the way, I'm voluntarily applying for excess leave without pay. I'm not sure that that's necessary given the Air Force regulations, but I'm just curious as to why it's in there.
Well, I think it's their way of trying to manipulate this in a way that they're not going to have to pay. They're using it kind of as a to move smoothly in conjunction with what parole is. And this is what is done in the parole scenario, and so that's what they're trying to fit this.
Well, what if he didn't? What if he didn't voluntarily? What if he crossed that out and said, I'm not doing this? What's happened? What happens?
Well, under the memorandum posted by the Chief of the Air Force Clinton Parole Board, he could be subject to court-martial, or maybe, probably the more likely scenario would be that you'd be subject to losing good time credit. However, I think what would really happen is that the regulation, the 51201 that guides the excess leave program, I think really indicates that this individual can be put on excess leave involuntarily.
Once he's out of confinement.
Once MSR is executed, I think they could do it anyway, but I think as a matter of, because they're trying to follow the parole, and that's how they've always done it, that's why they're using this.
You state in your brief that his MSR ran from his mandatory release date, or whatever that is, MRD, minimum release date, to the expiration of his sentence to confinement. Putting aside whether he actually attended the 24 months of sex offender, is that a true statement?
That he was on...
Is it your position that an MSR agreement that states you shall do something for an additional 24 months, or in this case 22 months, does not go past the expiration of his sentence? This is not it's a factual question. It's not a question as to whether it's punishment or whether there's jurisdiction. Right. I'm testing the accuracy of that sentence, not to do gotcha, but I want to understand whether I'm missing something.
Well, I think
how does 24 months not extend past 2 months?
Well, I think if you look at the attachment to the MSR certificate with those guidelines in there, it's not stating mandatorily you're going to do 24 months or you're going to be pulled back, because it says the treatment program should have a duration of at least 24 months. I think it's really indicating this is what we'd like you to do and like you to accomplish.
I will comply with any additional conditions of my parole listed on attached sheet.
Right. Well, but I think the language really is indicative of the fact that this is something they want him to do, but it's not something I think they envision that he's going to get pulled back on. Because
so if he
signs this piece of paper, and on September 3rd, he says, I am not going to the sex offender treatment program anymore, and they court-martial him for it, then he's got a good defense because he only had to sign up for something that was a good idea that he should do as opposed to something that he was required to do?
Is that the government's position? I think that language is, for lack of a better word, get-out-of-jail-free card. It's not as mandatory as the form.
Is it the government's position that the appellant's participation in the MSR was voluntary or not voluntary? It's a yes or no question. You can say I can't answer it yes or no, but I'm presenting it as a yes or no question. Was it voluntary or was it not voluntary?
Not voluntary.
Okay. Returning to Judge Erdman's hypothetical, let's say we have the affidavit from the person who ran the program for the 24 months or whatever saying, yeah, did it. How do we determine whether that is an increase in sentence or punishment? What test should we apply to that to distinguish between something that may be just a parole term versus or MSR term versus something that is an increase in sentence or punishment? And my second question, okay, I'll add one more question after that.
Okay. If I'm answering your question correctly, you're asking me how is it that we determine whether or not this was a punitive?
An increase to the sentence or punishment. I'm intentionally being vague because I don't want to. I want you to tell me what we're testing for, not me to tell you.
Right. Well, I think there's a couple of ways that we test this. First and foremost, I think it's Smith v. Doe, the Supreme Court case, that talks about the punitive nature of whatever it is that's being implemented with those factors that come into play with is there a congressional scheme? Is the punishment typically something that would be a punitive kind of thing? Those factors. Other than that, then I think this court looks to cruel and unusual punishment, the Farmer and the Brennan tests with regard to that scenario. So I think it's kind of a hodgepodge of tests.
I'm just trying to see if there's differences in law here. Is it the government's position that this appellant would or would not have jurisdiction to take these same claims into a federal district court? That's also a yes or no question.
He would.
So it's the government's position stated today that the appellant would have, you would not contest jurisdiction in a federal federal district court on these claims?
On the claims of whether or not, for example, the conditions are more onerous than they need to be, or those kinds of issues?
As raised in the brief of the appellant. Would a federal district court have jurisdiction over those claims?
It's the government's position they would.
Does the government have authority while someone is in confinement to make them pay for sex offender treatment?
That while they're in confinement?
Right. They're in confinement. They have a sex offender treatment program at a variety of these institutions. Does the government have authority to say, you know, we're tired of paying for these people to get treated, we're going to require them to pay for it from now on?
I'm not aware of that scenario happening. My understanding is that those programs are offered and they can volunteer for those. I'm not aware of whether they have to pay for the programs or not, why they're in confinement anyway.
So if an individual doesn't have to pay for that program, here, as I look to the MSR certificate, there are a number of things the individual is going to have to pay for. They're going to have to pay for that program. They're going to have to pay for the computer monitoring. What if that turns out to be thousands of dollars of cost to the individual? Why wouldn't that be? And I know we have questions as to what was introduced into evidence in this case, but assuming we have a documented case in which an individual says, if I had to spend, depending on how much time they have left on their sentence, might be a couple of years there. If I have to spend a couple of years this counseling program, and I have to have this sophisticated monitoring put on my computers at home and work and wherever else I am, that's going to cost me thousands of dollars. Where does the government have the authority to, and then the individual say, increase my punishment by making me pay for something that I wouldn't have to pay for while I was in confinement?
Well, I guess first I would say that ultimately, in the end, the freedom that he enjoys now certainly outweighs any of those costs. I don't know of any evidence that there would be any some onerous financial burden in the history of the program. I'm not aware of those kinds of things.
But well, that's a hypothetical. That is, an individual says, if you're going to do that to me, forget it. I'm going to stay here. I'm not going to go out there and have to be in a program where I'm going to have to pay thousands of dollars, and it's going to be so difficult for me to make those meetings and comply with those circumstances that I'm not sure I can get any job or anything more than the most menial job. And if that can be documented in the record, why isn't that an increase in the individual's punishment?
Well, again, I guess depending on the totality of the circumstances under your hypothetical, that's a difficult question to answer without having, you know, everything in front of me. So, I mean, I guess arguably, if you know there was thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for him to pay to do these kinds of things, then maybe it would be increasing the sentence at that point.
Thank you.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that this is a program, the MSR program, does not have any basis in statute and is therefore an overextension of the executive's authority?
Well, I would say that the legislative scheme suggests otherwise. That is, that when Congress delegated the authority to implement a parole program under Title 10, United States Code 952, that it was pretty clear that the department Defense Department heads, respective heads of their agency, would come up with a plan. Now, the fact that...
But this is not a parole or probation program, is it, or is it?
I think it is a parole. It is a parole program. It's an offshoot of a parole program that simply addresses those inmates that are violent offenders or sexual offenders, those offenders that we have more concern about releasing. And so this program is developed as a hybrid of parole to get them easy, smooth.
Well, I mean, the cases that have discussed this program in other jurisdictions have said this is very similar to parole and probation, and you know, is very parallel to it. And you just said that this is a hybrid of it. And I guess my question is this a part of the parole and probation program, or is it something that just looks like a lot like it?
No, it is the parole. I guess I say hybrid only because that there's, you know, only one distinguishing difference, and that is, you know, the seemingly mandatory nature. I guess they could turn it down.
So
it's a rock and hard place thing, but I'm sorry.
So this is a part of the parole and probation program? I mean,
yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and so my next question would be then why isn't it set forth under the parole and probation? Let me ask the question. Why is it not then set forth in the parole and probation regulations?
Well, it really is. In the DOD instruction, the applicable one, the 13.25.7, I believe it is, they all the parole, the good credit, those things are put in that instruction. In fact, when you're looking at the MSR paragraphs, I think it's 6.20, when you're talking about the revocation of MSR, it actually takes you back to the parole revocation process with the hearing and determining whether or not you, how much is revoked, do you get the time that you were out on parole, or does it go all the way back to the time that you were released, those kinds of things. So I think that's indicative that the fact that it's in the same instruction indicates that it's a parole. But again, this the tiny offshoot is that the mandatory nature of it.
Can I return you to Judge Efron's question? And I don't want to get lost in the hypothetical. An appellant goes before the MSR, and they have a year left. And the MSR board says, okay, in lieu of staying at Leavenworth for the next year, you're released and you have to pay $1,000 a week into this victim's fund for the duration of your sentence. Is that what's happening there? Is that a change to the sentence, putting aside whether it's increased, because that's a value judgment as to whether you'd rather be at Leavenworth or paying $1,000 a month or a week. Is that a change to the sentence?
Sorry if I could.
No, I think you have to think that through. You're also welcome to consult with that. You're allowed to consult if you need to, I think. Is that permitted?
Absolutely.
I think we have a consensus, Your Honor. I think if you're speaking of the onerous nature of a fine, a kind of a restitution kind of situation, that is typically a sentence that could be adjudged at a court-martial. And so by doing a restitution fine...
So you're focusing on my victim's fund.
I am, Your Honor.
You have to pay. Stand by. Fair enough. You have to pay $1,000 for sex offender treatment. We want only the best for the armed forces, and you're going to the University of Chicago Premier Psychology and Psychiatry Department.
Well, I think that ultimately in the certificates it talks about, or in the declarations that were submitted, that there is a negotiation process with regards to what offender classes you take and how much money and all that
now
stuff we've worked out.
We're stipulating, and I believe the government has stated in this case, that this is an involuntary program, so negotiation doesn't seem to be part of the game, especially negotiation predicated on being court-martialed if you don't accept the government's terms. If the government says $1,000, whatever it costs to go to the University of Chicago Psychiatric Department, or you will be court-martialed. What's the government's response to the same question?
Well, again, I don't want to poke or anything, but I think it is a negotiation when they're going through and looking at the conditions, because ultimately, before they do this, they have the process where he's given, you know, notice about the what's going on, and he can submit, you know, letters and all that kind of thing, and if they talk about the probation officer, you know, they can look at.
Do I infer from your answer, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, that if it were to negotiation, it would be a change to the sentence?
I would say, depending on the onerous conditions and whether or not they are related to the specific purpose that the MSR program is designed to do, which is you know, rehabilitate, ease him into society again, and for the protection of society in general.
What difference does the negotiation element add to it?
Well, I think it goes to the, more than anything, I think it goes to the fact that he really didn't solve this at the grassroots level, at least it's the government's contention, because what he could have done is he could have gone to his probation officer if these were onerous conditions. They could have made some changes.
But the question is whether or not they are conditions that increase the sentence. And if the government comes in and says, go to the University of Chicago sex offender program, which costs X amount for 24 months, and he comes in and says, I can't do it because it's too expensive, and they say, okay, do it for 12 months, it's still 12 months of an expensive program that wasn't in the initial sentence. So I'm not sure where the negotiation element really answers the question.
Well, I guess it becomes a you know, totality of the circumstances, and if you know you have a program that's like I said, designed to that has a close nexus to the purpose of the program, and the fact of the matter is, this individual is supposed to be, if I understand the financial situation of, you know, they're getting. Arguably, I'm not for sure on this, but getting the free programs in confinement. The bottom line is, it's hard to imagine an individual that would give up liberty in order to, you know, for monetary.
That's a value judgment, however. Is that a legal judgment?
It is. No, it is. I guess I quote from the Air Force Court. I didn't quote, but you know, the Air Force Court opinion, I think, hit on that.
You're familiar with the phrase, three hots in a cot?
I am, Your Honor.
Are there not people who would prefer the three hots in a cot?
You know, in light of the fact that he certainly was, and I see I'm out of time if I...
You may conclude.
Okay. In the end, the government requests this court to find they have no jurisdiction to consider the interplay of the MSR program, that is the administration and process and procedure set up, and that ultimately the MSR program is not punishment, and that in that light.
The MSR program or the conditions imposed pursuant to the MSR program in this case?
Both. The MSR program in general and the MSR program and conditions as applied to this case.
Thank you, counsel. Is there any rebuttal from the defense?
What's your response to the government's argument that this is just part of the parole and probation program? That's where the authority comes from.
Respectfully, Your Honor, this is not parole. Based on what the president has stated within the manual, what the definition of parole is a voluntary agreement. This is an involuntary imposition upon Senior Airman Pena. It is not parole. They have not been granted any authority to to impose mandatory supervised release.
Going to the now tortured Chicago scenario, why is that a change to the sentence and or an increase in the severity of the sentence rather than the MSR board exercising MSR authority, which either may or may not be within its regulatory authority?
It's an increase to his sentence.
Which is a jurisdictional question I'm really getting at.
It's an increase to his sentence because they're taking conditions that are, some of them are potentially authorized punishments, such as by making him attend these classes and paying for them.
And they put in the MSR as part of their process, has a statement saying, everything we do is to ease his transition back into society, and the reason we do these things is to protect society from sex offenders and to make sex offenders welcome back into society. Why is that an issue of a sentence or a punishment?
Your Honor, it's an issue of the sentence because they do not have the authority to impose those conditions upon the appellant. They are going outside of their authority to impose these conditions. They can impose certain conditions upon the appellant while he's in confinement, while he's in the four walls, but once they have no authority to impose these conditions outside, that once they do that, they are violating his due process rights and they're also increasing his sentence. Now, all of the government's false arguments should have raised a red flag for each one. The negotiation process, there is no negotiation process. If you clearly, in the letter that was written from the Air Force Clemency and Parole Board, it specifically states, you shall provide the board a mandatory supervised release plan. You will forward the plan with your facility commander no later than 30 days, and the plan shall include a residence stating where you are going to live, guaranteed employment, and acceptance into a valid educational or vocational program, a requirement that you shall register with your state registration, comply with your state registrations. There is nothing about any negotiation in what conditions will be placed upon him. And he contested the conditions. He sent a letter to his commander, to the Naval Brig commander, contesting these conditions. Clearly, there was no negotiation. And Congress has defined these conditions as punishment. And Congress has, in the federal civilian criminal system, these conditions, some of them, could be imposed under their form of supervised release. And they're imposed as part of the sentence. Now, the Court of Military Appeals in 1992 in Navy case where there was an authorized punishment of bread and water as punishment when the ship is out to sea. However, when they were on land, they could not authorize that punishment, and that was a violation of Article 55. And it's similar to this case where this is punishment. And they cannot, the prison officials and the Air Force Clemency and Parole Board together cannot increase Senior Airman Pena's sentence with the conditions of MSR and with imposing MSR on them. And it most definitely is not parole. It's involuntary, it's an involuntary imposition on Senior Airman Pena under a threat of a court martial. And he could not, if he violated it, he was failing to obey an order, and he could have been court-martialed and lose discipline and go to a disciplinary board. This court is and ought to be the great protector of the rights and of service members and servicemen and women who don't put aside their rights when they don the uniform. We respectfully ask that this court reaffirm that in this country, officials cannot deprive a citizen of his liberty or of property without due process of law. These were a burden upon himself and upon his family, and he let them know that, and they continued. So what the government did is contrary to our legal tradition, and to we ask this court to reaffirm that the that it is a constitutional democracy, that in a constitutional democracy, a bureaucrat is not able to take away liberty when it is a good idea. The imposition of...
Counsel, I believe your time has expired. I'll briefly conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. The imposition of NSR is without sanction of the Constitution and without sanction of the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and it must fall as it has been applied to Senior Airman Pena. Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank counsel for both sides for your presentation today, and we will take a brief 5-minute recess, and we will reconvene at 10:15 to hear the Lee case. Our second case this morning is United States v. Lee. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of this court, good morning. My name is Major John Page, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellant in this matter, Airman Basic Joseph Lee. Now, this case is about fundamental notions of fairness and conducting courts martial on a level playing field. In this case, the military judge abused his discretion when he denied the defense request for an expert in the field of computer forensics analysis and, more specifically, digital media analysis. And this abuse of discretion occurred on page 17 of the record of trial when the military judge was explaining the basis for denying that expert assistance. And the judge, in particular, on page 17, cited three reasons that he was going to deny that expert assistance. The first, he explained that the trial defense counsel had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Beretkowski, who was the government's expert. And he also stated that the government was not aware of any particular defects in his testing procedure, and that also the court was not aware of any apparent defects in the testing procedure. Now, to follow the military judge's reasoning in this particular case would mean that in future cases, a military accused would rarely have the opportunity to obtain expert assistance. Now, as a practical matter, the denial of this expert assistance, the denial of the employment of an expert consultant, effectively cut off the appellant from being able to mount any kind of an attack on the real versus virtual distinction of these photographs. And that's a pivotal issue in this case, is the real versus virtual distinction. As this court stated in United States versus O'Connor, if the government is going to proceed under the Child Pornography Prevention Act, in their prosecution, they must prove that the images actually are of real children. This court has also explained in United States versus Sendejas that when the government presents that evidence to the trier of fact, that an accused is entitled then to present their own evidence as to that real versus virtual distinction in attacking the government's evidence and being able to mount the defense. Now, this court has frequently employed a three-prong analysis in looking at whether or not expert assistance is necessary in a particular case. The first prong of that analysis is, why is the expert needed? And we would submit that that was sufficiently demonstrated in both Appellate Exhibit 2, which was the defense written motion for expert assistance to the military judge, and also on the record. The trial defense counsel clearly articulated that an expert in this case was needed to analyze these images, to look at that real versus virtual distinction, to be able to actually take a look at the methods of analysis that were used in this case, which were relatively new, and also to develop any potential areas of cross-examination. The second prong that this court has examined is, what would the expert accomplish for the defense? And the key here is that the expert assistance would have provided the defense with an opportunity. And that's the key, an opportunity to meaningfully challenge the real versus virtual distinction. There's no actual requirement that the defense has to show that by obtaining this expert consultant that favorable information would then be able to be presented at trial. And in one of the cases which is cited in the government's brief, United States versus Bresnahan, both Chief Judge Efron and Judge Erdman, in the dissenting opinion in that case, I think I wanted to clarify that that's not a requirement that actually that an appellant demonstrate that there is favorable information that they would be able to present as a precursor to being able to obtain expert assistance. And here again, in Sendejas, this court emphasized that when the government goes forward with expert assistance to present evidence that these are actual images of real children, that an accused is then entitled to confront that evidence. And in this case, the appellant was only meaningfully able to do that through the employment of an expert consultant.
Counsel, just for a moment, let's put aside the issue as to whether or not the defense was entitled to an expert and go to the military judge's statement in his decision where he said, well, I relied on the government's expert, but in addition, I relied upon my own judgment and my own experience and common sense, blah, 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 which in Sendejas we said was sufficient. Does that statement, why shouldn't we just go to that statement by the military judge and say, you know, that's sufficient under Sendejas?
The reason that you should not do that, Your Honor, is because, I mean, the military judge made that statement without the defense being able to present any kind of a defense regarding the real versus virtual distinction. I think as this court did state in Sendejas, that even though in Sendejas there was a military judge, there was a trier of fact as well, and this court had emphasized that being able to go forward with evidence as to the real versus virtual distinction may have been able to change the fact finder's mind in that case as to whether or not the images were in fact virtual versus real.
How would your argument today be different, if the government had not called an expert on the real versus virtual distinction?
Your Honor, our argument would be the same, that the defense was still entitled to expert assistance in this case, because just the area itself of the real versus distinction, real versus virtual images, the record of trial in this case indicated that it's such a highly technical area of computer forensics analysis that in order to be able to meaningfully, you know, look at whether or not there is evidence of these images being virtual, the only way to meaningfully do that is to have an expert consultant who specializes in this area and can adequately identify and develop that evidence. Now, the third prong of the test that this court has employed is looking at whether or not the defense counsel is able to gather and present this evidence on its own. In this case, on the record, the trial defense counsel made abundantly clear that he did not have the background or the expertise to adequately pursue this matter, or that he was able to obtain this assistance from anybody in his chain of command. And I think it's important, extremely helpful to note that in the government's or the testimony of the government's expert witness, he stated that in the entire Department of Defense, that there's only approximately three individuals that are actually qualified to perform this method of analysis, and Mr. Berdkowski was one of those individuals. Now, again, the military judge in this case abused his discretion when he went through that analysis on page 17 of the record. And when he stated that the trial defense counsel had an opportunity to question Mr. Berdkowski, the military judge never explained how that then enabled the defense counsel to be able to perform this process on his own. And the other two items mentioned by the military judge, that being whether or not there were any defects that Mr. Berdkowski described, or whether or not the court was aware of any particular defects, really has no bearing on that three-pronged analysis. And regarding prejudice in this case, We respectfully submit that this court should presume that there was prejudice. Now, in United States versus Warner, that's what this court did. It began with a presumption that there was prejudice. Now, Warner was a little bit different in that case, the defense was given an expert, but it was found that the expert did not have sufficient qualifications. And this court listed a number of factors that it would look at in determining whether or not prejudice should be presumed. Now, while in this case we have obviously no expert provided, so the analysis, some of those factors aren't going to similarly apply, but to begin with, the first two factors obviously do, in that, first of all, no expert assistance was provided, and second of all, the government provided themselves an expert in this field of digital image analysis. This court in Warner also recognized just the inherent difficulties in establishing prejudice in this type of a case to begin with. That by not being provided expert assistance, the child defense counsel is really precluded from being able to present any indication of how the case could have potentially turned out differently. Now, attacking the real versus virtual distinction of those images was really the defense's most potentially fruitful defense in this case. The trial defense counsel also touched on a couple different areas as far as whether or not these images were knowingly downloaded and whether or not they actually constituted pornography, but I think a reading of the record makes clear that really the gist or the area, the potential defense with the most essentially, the most effective defense available to the trial defense counsel was certainly the real versus virtual distinction of the images. And the trial defense counsel was really unable, again, because of this is a technically sophisticated area, as evidenced by the testimony from Mr. Brodkowski, the different processes involved in analyzing these images. This was something that the trial defense counsel was wholly unable to perform on his own. So the interest of justice in this case would best be served by allowing the appellant to have that opportunity to go back to trial and being able to demonstrate how the evidentiary posture of this case would change were he given that opportunity to employ expert assistance and be able to examine whether there was a potential defense there that he could raise at trial dealing with the virtual, real distinction of the images. And it's for that reason that we would ask this court to set aside the findings and the sentence in this case to enable him to do so.
What can you point to us now as fruitful areas of inquiry based upon any analysis that's been done subsequent to trial as to whether this would even be meaningful or not to have the expert that the defense requested?
Is any analysis subsequent to trial, Your Honor?
Right. In other words, Why, in terms of prejudice, you could look at presumed prejudice and not even examine any further, or you could say before we're going to presume prejudice in something like this, we're going to look to see whether there's any fruitful area of inquiry that an expert might have provided something useful to the defense.
Well, from the record of trial itself, Your Honor, I don't think that there's anything within the record itself that can really be identified as, but that in itself is really part of the problem with the case, is that because an expert was never provided to the defense, they really never had that opportunity to explore whether or not there was a different angle that could have been presented with respect to the digital pictures.
But this isn't a unique prosecution. The prosecution's going on all over the country dealing with these pornography cases and the real versus actual determination. Is there any indication in those cases that there was a fruitful area of inquiry that an expert could have assisted the defense on with in this particular case in terms of challenging the government's expert?
Well, as far as other specific cases, I mean, not specifically that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I mean, certainly, I think it's certainly recognized that the level of technology that's employed in you know, creating some of these virtual images has become more sophisticated over time, and because of that, I mean, it's going to be obviously more difficult to just identify on the face of the image as to whether or not this is something that was potentially created. So that's part of the difficulty in proceeding without expert assistance, is that a trial defense counsel is typically not going to have the tools, so to speak, to be able to identify those circumstances.
But here, do we even know what questions the defense counsel would want to have an expert take a look at? Or is the issue one of when technology is at issue, all the defense has to say is technology is at issue, and if the judge denies the ruling, there's a presumption in favor of the defense? Is that your theory of the case?
No, Your Honor, but I'm sorry, your original question was just...
Well, my question is, what showing does the defense need to make in order to invoke a presumption of prejudice? What showing does the defense need to make about what areas of inquiry would be pursued by the defense in cross-examining an expert? Is it enough for the defense to simply say, there's technology at issue here, we're not scientists, we need somebody to help us figure out what we need to know? Or does the defense, either at trial or on appeal, have to be able to show the court there's something fruitful that would result from the employment of an expert?
Well, Your Honor, I think the appellant's in a position where he's not really able to show if there's anything that is potentially fruitful until he's actually given an expert to be able to look at the evidence in question. Now, during the trial itself, obviously, and in this case as well, the trial defense counsel pointed out that that this was an area that they wanted to explore, but I think just on the particular facts of this case and the subject area that it's dealing with, the digital photographs and the technology involved in it, is an area where I think it puts a defense counsel and an appellant in a position where without that expert assistance, they're not really going to be able to identify, you know, for a military judge, you know, what specifically it is that they're going to do. And if there are no further questions at this time, that's all I have at this point.
Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court. I'm Major Matthew Ward, and I, along with Colonel Roger Bruce, represent the United States in this matter today. Appellant is entitled to no relief. He's failed at trial and before this court to demonstrate that it was necessary for him to have the appointment of a defense confidential consultant. In order to prevail, an accused must demonstrate something more than a possibility of assistance from a required expert. An accused must show the trial court that there exists a reasonable probability both that an expert would be of assistance to the defense and that denial of expert assistance would result in a fundamentally unfair trial. Appellant failed to do so at the trial level.
Well, let's start from this premise. The government felt that this was an area of such technical sophistication that it required an expert. And I think that the expert and the parties agreed that this was an area that was rapidly developing and changing, and the government put the expert on and utilized it. How then can you say that the defense has an equal opportunity to expert witnesses if the trial judge refuses him the ability to even consult with his own expert?
Well, so I'd answer that in two ways. First of all, the trial judge put on the record and made sure that the defense did have the opportunity to consult with a government expert.
Well, with a government expert who's paid to represent the government, I don't know if in litigation that is an accepted source for providing information to the defense.
Well, in cases, if the defense can make a showing of partiality or somehow that they were prejudiced by the fact that they only had the government expert, but...
Are you making the argument that the government expert is really the defense expert as well?
I'm saying that the government expert, sir, is a resource available to the defense from which they can use a stepping stone if they need to establish that an area of...
But the government expert is there to support the government's case.
Right.
He's not there to poke holes in the government's case.
But even just to establish the fact that the defense would need an expert, sir, the...
Well, okay, let's just go back then. To establish whether the defense needs an expert, why does the government need an expert in this case?
I would say, sir, based on the case law, as this court obviously knows, the Nijhaus just recently came out, 2005 case, I believe, which indicated that a trial, a finder of fact, could look at the images and make their own determination whether they were real images or virtual images. Prior to that, that was an unsettled question. So the government was in a position of saying, well, how do we establish that these photos, which obviously look real to the naked eye, is that enough for the appellate courts? So at that point, I believe just an abundance of caution, they said, well, let's get an expert in who will analyze the pictures, and perhaps that will be enough. We'll have an expert opinion, and that could be enough of a basis for the court to ultimately find on appeal that was the burden was met. I mean, there's been federal courts where you had pediatricians who come in who had some photographic expertise who looked at it and said, yeah, I've seen photos, it looks like a real photo to me, and that was enough.
But having chosen to avail themselves to that expert testimony, is the government's position that it is not unfair to deprive the defense access to any expert?
Well, again, sir, they weren't deprived access to any expert, and the question of whether they're entitled to their own expert, they have to meet the burden. The defense has the burden under Gary's and Gonzalez's demonstrating that they need an expert, that what that expert could accomplish for the defense, and why they couldn't accomplish the same thing on their own. So the issue is not just because the government has an expert.
Well, can you go through those three elements for us, please?
Yes, sir. Regarding the first element, why is an expert needed? And the defense has put forth why they believe an expert was needed. In their motion, they indicated that the issue at the court would be whether the images were real, and a defense expert could advise on weaknesses in the government's expert's testimony, and an expert could conduct his own analysis of the images. Basically, they wanted to use their expert to help with impeachment. In the request of the convening authority's attachment, they indicated that forensic computer analysis was a complex field. They wanted an expert to analyze the report and provide insight into accuracy and possible defenses. In other words, they're saying they wanted to have an expert tell them if there's any potential defenses out there. So that all goes to the first factor, why they needed an expert. But the second factor is where they failed. The second factor is what could an expert accomplish for them. Today, the defense has said that this answered the second problem by saying an expert would have provided a real opportunity to challenge the expert. But with all due respect to the defense, that's again going back to prong one. Why do they believe they need an expert? That doesn't say that an expert would actually be able to accomplish that.
But how do they know that if they don't have an expert to talk to that is dedicated to their position?
Well, going to the Bresnahan case, which is, I believe, the most recent case on this issue, there was the majority opinion and a dissent, but the key factor for both was that, in that case, ultimately the majority found that the defense had to articulate or have some evidence of false confession. That case involved whether or not a confession made by a father or guardian how his baby was injured was a false confession. And the defense wanted an expert in false confessions in order to challenge the confession. The majority held, well, there was no evidence the confession was false. The defense had failed to provide any evidence enough to support the second prong and to get an expert. But even the dissent in there said that they would require the defense to make a colorable showing of a defense, which they believe the defense had done in that case, and then to go through the Gonzalez factors with regard to that particular defense. Here, the appellant has not done so. He has not articulated a potential defense. In that case, the defense counsel in Bresnahan, the defense counsel did independent research. She got materials together. She presented that to the court and said, this is as far as I can go. I've made the effort to try and to identify the defense, and she articulated a defense. In this case, the appellant just keeps coming back and says, I need an expert because I want to have a good impeachment, because I want to find something wrong, but hasn't indicated what that would be, hasn't indicated that there was a problem in the process.
Well, but doesn't that go back to how do they know what the problem is in this very technical area unless they have someone with the technical expertise to tell them that?
With all due respect, sir, this isn't a DNA case. If you go through the record and you go through the expert's testimony and actually the media analysis report, it's not that complicated. This is not a forensic analysis of a computer. This is basically, if the expert describes his process, And he basically looks at a picture to see if it's plausible, just with the naked eye. He checks the proportions of the individual in the picture to make sure that they're proportionate.
Well, then, could you explain to me pixelation? What's that concept mean?
He indicated what one of the initial things they do is they just blow up an image. In other words, they magnify it on the computer until you can see the individual points that, like the dots that make up the entire picture, and then you would look for problems in that area. And again, if you go to the media analysis report, I think it becomes clear. But even beyond that, that is something that the government expert could have explained to the defense counsel. I mean, the defense counsel had access to an expert to explain the process in general, as opposed to impeaching his own report.
Well, is there ever a time then in this field where the defense would be entitled to an expert?
Yes, if they can meet the satisfy the Gonzales factors. Well, an example would be in this particular field.
Well, in this field, if they're refused an expert at trial, is there ever an instance where they would be able to satisfy those standards under the government's theory?
Yes, so I don't believe so. Under the process utilized by this expert in this case, I mean, I don't know how far digital imagery analysis has gone since then, but I want to emphasize that if you read the report, basically the expert took the picture and put it on Adobe Photo Editor, and he said any photo editor would work, commercially available, and he hit a number of buttons which were filters, and then he just looked at it. And so the issue with regard to the BOSS relief, which indicates textures on the picture, says if there's large flat areas, which means solid colors, that's indicative of computer-generated images because people have imperfections in their skin. There's flesh, under the flesh there's muscle, fat, whatever, which causes a difference in the topography of the skin, which wouldn't be indicated in a computer-generated image. That's not hard to grasp. You can get that from reading the record. Defense counsel could have gotten that from talking to the expert.
And you discount the cases from the other federal jurisdictions where courts and experts have said that it's virtually impossible in some instances for even an expert to determine the difference.
I'm not aware of those cases. So I believe there's one case where one court may have done that, but I don't recall the name. But my understanding is the vast majority of federal courts have said you can just tell if pictures are real by just looking at them. That's going back to, I believe it's a Dayhouse case. So it's the government's position that the defense has failed to make any showing under what an expert could actually accomplish, what questions he could have provided, or what areas he could have provided of insight that the defense could have pursued, which makes a third Gonzales factor, why is defense counsel unable to accomplish the same thing, hard to analyze.
But going back to the second factor, if the defense counsel says, I understand what that scientist is telling me, I'm not a scientist. What does the defense counsel then do to determine whether there are either contradictory scientific theories or consistent scientific theories there that would say you need to have a scientific background in order to make that particular analysis? That is, the courts have said, and we've said in Sendejas, that a layperson can make the ultimate judgment, real versus virtual. But if the issue is then brought into the trial, not the lay judgment, but the scientific judgment, what does the defense counsel have to show to say, well, that's that one scientist's point of view, this is an emerging field, we should have another scientist take a look at that? What does the defense counsel have to show to say, I need another scientist to see whether they come to the same conclusion, the same scientific conclusion, not the same lay conclusion?
Well, I believe in U.S. v. Ford, the issue in that case was whether or not a device was a firecracker or a bomb. And in that case, the defense had been provided with their own expert. And their position was that they weren't able to get evidence from the government expert supporting their theory, basically. The court found that that's what the defense wanted, that they were looking for an expert who would basically contradict what the government expert had said. But the court also said in that case they have to provide some information or some basis that there such an expert exists. In other words, you can't get an expert appointed to find another expert to find another expert eventually until you get the one who will agree with the defense's position. The defense has an obligation, burden, to make a showing that an expert is necessary. And to do that, again, they could have talked to the government expert, and they did get this because it came out of impeachment, is that there was someone else in this individual's office who had disagreed with him on the analysis of one of the photos. So the defense was able to get impeachment evidence. But they could have said, okay, are there other experts? Is this, what other resources? What training materials do you have? It was indicated in the voir dire of the expert that he was trained. So the defense had an avenue, a stepping stone, through the government expert to get to other experts or to get to other materials. They weren't flailing around blindly. There's no evidence that they did that, but it's possible they did and determined that there was no other expert who would contradict this expert. We don't know based on the record. But they were provided an opportunity, a resource, from which to develop their case that an expert was necessary, and that was the government expert. Beyond whether or not he had to contradict his own report, he could have just explained the science, and if he couldn't do so sufficiently to satisfy the defense's ability to cross-examine, they could have made that case to the military judge. They did not. They basically said that they didn't make the claim that we talked to the government expert and we don't understand. They made the case to the judge that the government expert is a government expert, we want our own. That's not sufficient under Gonzales.
So the defense would have to show in this case that there is some skepticism somewhere that about these, let's say, the observations of the skin tones in the pixels, that's something that's judgmental as opposed to scientifically established in an irrefutable sense. What is it the defense has to show to say, I want somebody else to look at this?
I think they would have to show that there's at least a culpable argument or some sort of argument out there that this is an area of dispute or there is disagreement among experts regarding this particular process or the science in general. That goes more to a Daubert challenge, but which they did not make in this case. But with regard to this case, that's what they would have had done, to say, okay.
Well, it's not a Daubert challenge that we're talking about here. It's an as-applied challenge. That is, no disagreement that the science exists out there, because I don't understand the defense to be doing that. The defense is not challenging whether the science exists. They're challenging whether it was properly applied.
Correct, sir. But if you just look at the Daubert analysis, because that generally requires that the science be peer-reviewed, that it be generally accepted in the relevant community, that it has a known error rate, or the typical factors under Daubert, one assumes, since the defense didn't make the challenge, that all that exists for this particular science. So there is material out there for them to access. And again, it's a new field, but they had an expert who could have directed them to those resources so they could develop their motion, so they could demonstrate before the judge and meet their burden that an expert was necessary. They failed to do so in this case.
So is the defense failure in this case a failure to claim that the expert was needed to make the Daubert challenge?
No, sir. Presumably the science is good. I don't think you can infer that there's a Daubert challenge when the defense specifically precluded it twice. And in fact, that it's so one time when the government was actually going down with a witness about the reliability and the known error rate and things like that regarding the science. The military judge, based on the defense representation, cut that off. So one presumes that the defense wasn't going to be happy with the answers. In other words, it was going to meet the Daubert challenge.
Going back to the defense citation of Warner, the defense has cited Warner for the proposition that there's a presumption of prejudice if there's error. If in this case we were to conclude that the judge should have authorized an expert, and I'm not asking the government to concede that at this point, but if we were to make that conclusion, what's your argument as to whether there is or is not a presumption of prejudice and what needs to be shown to establish that presumption?
Well, it's the government's position that the appointment of an expert for the defense would accomplish nothing for the defense. But if one were to assume that it accomplished everything for the defense, in other words, that they had an expert who had some silver bullet that he could pull out and just totally destroy the credibility of the government expert.
No, that's not my question. It's an in-between question, and that is the defense argument at its outset is the defense at trial needed an expert in order to be able to determine whether there was something to cross-examine the government on. That is, the defense hasn't shown, let's assume the defense hasn't shown a silver bullet on appeal. So what's your argument on the issue of a presumption of prejudice? Because if you have a presumption of prejudice, then that means that the defense doesn't have to show that there's a silver bullet.
Well, it's government's position that he absolutely doesn't have a presumption of prejudice, and none of the case law supports that with regard to whether experts should be appointed. Warner is a separate issue. Warner,
that's my question. If we assume that an expert should have been appointed for purposes of allowing the defense to explore whether or not there were avenues of cross-examination, let's say that that's our holding in this case. What's the government's position on whether there's a presumption of prejudice at that stage?
At that stage, based on Warner, since the issue obviously would have been that the defense was entitled to an expert, and no expert is not the equivalent of the government expert, then the presumption under Warner would apply. However,
the presumption applies even if the defense can't show what it would have done with the information.
Assuming that they get past the Gonzales factors and they were entitled to an expert.
Okay.
Because, again, at that point, no expert is certainly not going to be reasonably comparable to an expert. However, that presumption can be rebutted simply by looking at the record. In this case, what the defense wanted the expert for was impeachment. They wanted to impeach the report, and they wanted to impeach the government expert. So assume that they had the silver bullet and they could impeach him and just totally destroy his credibility. Then the government is left with the judge still having to make a determination of whether the pictures were real or virtual. And the judge was quite clear in his findings of fact that he based his findings that they were real pictures based on the confession or the statements of the accused to the OSI agent and to his roommate, which he said was bolstered by the testimony of the experts, the pediatrician and the government digital expert. But that was just bolstered. But then he went on to say, independent of both those factors, he, based on his common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world, he finds that they were real children.
So it's your view that the judge was saying, irrespective of the expert?
Yes, sir. I mean, specifically the judge said, applying common sense, knowledge of human nature and the ways of the world, he found he was independently convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the images were of real children ranging in ages from 6 to 10. So that takes the expert entirely out of the equation. So if they had an expert who had come up with a magic question that the expert couldn't answer, or the judge had said, okay, you're right, I'm going to exclude the testimony of the expert, I'm going to exclude the report, the judge still has to answer the question, are these real or are these not? And he answered the question, he would have found that they were real independent of both the accused's confession and of the testimony of the expert. And again, if you look at the strength of the case, again, Prosecution Exhibit 1, which is the appellant's confession, his statements to Special Agent Chase, that he believed he was looking at child porn and that he defined child porn as naked pictures of naked girls, and his statement to Jonathan Lee, when Jonathan Lee asked him, do you know how old the girls are in the pictures, he said that they were 10. The appellant obviously believed that they were real pictures. Again, it's the government's position that the defense achieved everything they could have achieved going to the third Gonzales factor. They impeached the government expert. What they brought out in voir dire was that he had no training in graphic design, photography, computer animation, and no degree in computer science. They indicated that his training was only a two-day course and another course of a few hours in an FBI seminar, that the image analysis process that was being utilized in this case was only a year old, that the expert had only analyzed 30 to 50 images, and that he had never been qualified as an expert in this area before. And during cross, they brought up a deficiency in the report or a problem in the report, which was spiking, which the expert explained clearly on the record what that was and the, what was caused, what was the cause of it. And he also brought up the fact that other experts could disagree based on a discrimination of what was the light sources. In other words, the defense did impeach the expert, they did impeach the report, and they made no demonstration of how an expert would have enhanced that impeachment in any way. Given that they failed to meet the Gonzales factors, they weren't entitled to an expert. But if they had, as this court has asked, had they met it, was there any prejudice that the government can show and the record supports that there was no prejudice to the appellant? Therefore, he's entitled to no relief, and his conviction should stand. There's no questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Just in response to the government's analysis of the second prong about what would the expert accomplish for the defense, the record of trials is fairly straightforward in this respect that the appellant in this case needed the expert assistance in order to be able to effectively challenge the government's case on that pivotal issue in prosecutions under the CPPA about whether or not the images are of real children or whether the images are altered or some way constitute virtual images. And the nature of this particular area of real versus virtual digital images is such that the more indistinguishable the images become in terms of the real versus virtual, the more difficult it is to be able to discern the difference between the two. Certainly the argument can be made that that's all the more reason that in a particular case, a defense needs expert assistance in order to be able to effectively challenge the evidence. And when that assistance was not forthcoming in this case, the appellant was prejudiced in not being able to effectively mount an attack on that evidence. Now, the government also alluded to this process of digital image analysis being relatively simple. We would respectfully submit that the record of trial indicates otherwise, that this was a fairly sophisticated technical area, again, with a limited number of individuals qualified to perform this analysis, and it was simply something that was beyond the ability of the defense counsel to effectively attack on his own. Also in consideration of the fact that this was a relatively new area where other labs could have differing methods of analysis and opinions on the actual images themselves. And it's for that reason, again, that the appellant in this case is prejudiced and would ask that this court set aside the findings and the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted, and we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. We will take a brief recess, and we will reconvene at 11 a.m. for the Hardison case. Third case this morning is United States against Hardison. Counsel for appellant.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron. Good morning, this honorable court. May it please this court. I am Major Orlando Sanchez for the appellant, Stephen Vangel S. Hardison. With this court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for a rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Rule for Courts Martial 1001B sets forth the five general categories of matters that may be presented by the prosecution against the appellant during the pre-sentencing phase of a trial. Rule 1001B is essentially a gate through which all of these matters may have to pass through, actually. If a matter cannot pass through 1001B, it essentially stands outside of that gate. In this case, we have evidence of pre-service drug use that stands outside of that gate. This evidence, the admission of this evidence was error on the part of the military judge. It was plain error, which needs to be reversed. First of all, the error, it was clear. It was not tied to anything in aggravation. It was not tied to the appellant's military history. It was not tied to her efficiency while in the military. It was mainly checking the box that's contained in both prosecution exhibits 14 and 15. It was also a clear error in that...
Counsel, does that distinguish this case from a case in which there is pre-service drug use, which is not part of an individual's military record, which is brought in, let's say, by a witness unrelated to the military? This individual used drugs at a particular time. Here we have a case which, as part of the individual's enlistment process and military experience, the, as I understand trial counsel's argument, at least from a plain error point of view, was saying this military policy against drug use was impressed upon this person as part of their enlistment process, as opposed to saying this is a person who's a repeated drug user and you can look back in their pre-service experience to see that.
If I understand your question, Chief Judge Efron, it would distinguish a case where, for example, a witness testified to it in a different context. For example, in a case in rebuttal. In those kinds of cases, which we don't have here, in this case, it could possibly come in.
I'm talking about from the other perspective. I understand the argument that where you have pre-service drug use, which is unconnected to one's military experience, there's an argument that that should be excluded under the rule.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understand, what trial counsel was trying to do here was to draw that connection by not simply pointing at the existence of pre-service drug use, but pointing to the enlistment process itself, that as part of coming into the military, this individual was focused on the impropriety of drug use because their pre-service experience had to be waived as part of the process. And therefore, that's a factor that should be taken into account in aggravation. Now, whether or not that is a correct interpretation of the underlying rule, why doesn't that, from a plain error analysis, take us into an environment where the error itself is not plain?
Well, Your Honor, it would have to go through the standards that this court has set in different cases on admitting prior bad acts in aggravation. It still needs to go through the 1001B gate. This court has said that if you have prior bad acts, they may be admitted, but they need to go through a certain analysis. For example, was it a continuous course of conduct? Was it tied to the military community? And for example, United States versus Mullins, United States versus Norse, this court addressed those issues. Although those cases involved prior bad acts that were committed while the person was still in the military. Here, we have something that's even more attenuated. We have prior bad acts that were committed before the appellant entered the military. Which makes it even less aggravating. It makes it aggravating in that it does tie it into it does paint the picture of the appellant as a multiple user, but it's improper aggravation under 1001B.
Where would you point to in the record where the prosecution focused on the multiple user aspect of this?
In the prosecutor's closing sentencing argument, Your Honor. She knew better. She came in on a drug label. She knew the Navy's drug policy, and she violated it anyway. She knew she would have to be tested, yet she chose to do drugs anyway.
Doesn't that sound like the prosecutor saying it's because of the waiver and the waiver circumstances is aggravated, as opposed to it's because we've got a high school drug user here who's used it again?
No, Your Honor. I probably disagree with that characterization. This was admitted, first of all, argument made in drug policy, which this court has said is improper, but also as an aggravating element. It would have needed to have passed through 1001B. The lower court clearly set out the landscape of how this kind of issue needed to be addressed. For 28 years, after United States versus Martin, the lower court didn't have to address that issue, neither did this court, until now. But the lower court has said, in this case, where the landscape is unclear. In United States versus Martin, the landscape was very clear, at least as set out by the lower court. And again, in United States versus Honeycutt, the court again explained how this kind of evidence needs to be dealt with. Other courts have dealt with a similar issue. United States versus Bauman, the Coast Guard court, dealt with this issue. Again, consistent with United States versus Martin. So there was a clear error in this case. The military judge should have known, as other judges have known for the last 28 years, that this kind of evidence should not come in. And yet, he allowed it to come in. Finally, this error, which is also a clear error, materially prejudiced the appellant. First of all, this was a member's case, which is unlike United States versus Gorenz. In United States versus Gorenz, this court dealt with a similar type of issue of pre-service drug use. This court assumed error and then afterward stated that the error was harmless because it was a military judge alone case. Unlike Gorenz, this case involved members. And the members were instructed by the military judge to consider the pre-service drug use evidence as evidence in aggravation. The prosecutor, as stated before, did effectively argue this issue before the members in his closing argument. Essentially, it was a very short closing argument that focused on this issue. And the entire sentencing case on the part of the government was so short that all it involved was one page of the record in which he admitted or moved to admit prosecution exhibits 10 to 15, through 16, and then rested his case, and afterward argued his case.
Counsel, is there ever a circumstance where a piece of evidence is not admissible under 1001B2 as a part of a serviceman's record, but is in a serviceman's record, the evidence is contained in there, that would be admissible then under 1001B4 as aggravation? If you can't get in one door, is it permissible to go into another door?
Yes, Your Honor, and this court made that very clear in United States v. Gorenz. In this case, the government has conceded that it does not come in under 1001B2. The appellant agrees with that, of course. So does it come in under 1001B4? And the appellant's position is that it does not.
Because it's not evidence in aggravation?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what are your best couple arguments that it's not?
The best argument, Your Honor, is that it is not directly tied to the offenses committed. And it has nothing to do with any military history, any military efficiency. It's essentially a check in the box, as stated before.
Well, does it have to go back and have something to do with military history if we're not coming in under B2?
Well, Your Honor, it needs to have a certain amount of reliability other than a check in the box, as happened in Mullins and Norse. It needs to have, for example, 1001B3 talks about convictions, and is very clear about how those convictions need to come in. In this case, we have a unsworn check in the box from the appellant that she used drugs 6 months prior to her signing this contract. We don't know exactly what the circumstances were. We do know that she was materially prejudiced by it because it was argued by the government and considered by the members as instructed. However, there is no quantum of reliability for this evidence to have come in. The military judge, if he had...
Were you arguing reliability or that it's not directly related?
That it's not directly related, Your Honor. But also...
So, focus on Judge Erdman's question. What are your three best arguments that it's not directly related?
Well, that would be the one argument, Your Honor, that it's not directly related.
Because it's not reliable?
Because it has nothing, because it is completely irrelevant to the offenses committed in this case, Your Honor.
And the government will say it has something to do with drugs.
Yes, Your Honor, but it would be tantamount to a prior bad act. It has to do with drugs, but there's nothing else. It would need to be tied to the offenses as it was in United States versus Honeycutt, where the lower court was in Honeycutt stated that because the accused in that case was convicted of drug use, which was a transfer and sale of drugs, and he had stated in his service contract that he knew the drugs were bad, that it aggravated the offenses because it showed that he wouldn't use drugs himself, but he would sell them to other people. In this case, we don't have that. We have a urinalysis pump in which the accused did not, the appellant did not testify, and she was convicted of it. We don't know what the circumstances around that urinalysis test were. We just know that she was found guilty of it. And then we have a check in the box from her service contract. There is no direct relation in aggravation to these, between these two uses.
What's your response to the CCA's argument that the law was uncertain, so what was the judge to do?
Your Honor, for 28 years, the law has been very certain. In United States v. Martin, the lower courts...
Let me be more specific then. The CCA asserts that there is a conflict between Huddingcutt and Martin. Do you agree?
The only conflict that exists between Huddingcutt and Martin, Your Honor, is whether or not Martin only applies to the 1001B2 issues, or if it applies on a plenary scale to the entire 1001B categories. The appellant's argument is that Martin applies to all categories in aggravation, or rather in the pre-sentencing case.
So you would argue that in doing an analysis under 1001B4, you would also look to say, okay, we're not going to look past the enlistment period?
Your Honor, I see my time is over.
Can I answer the question?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, we can't look outside of the enlistment period in certain circumstances, and the appellant would agree on that. And in this case, it does not present those circumstances. I'm not sure if that answers the question.
That answers it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counselor. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, my name is Lieutenant Justin Dunlap, and I am arguing for the government. During sentencing, the trial counsel introduced portions of the appellant's enlistment paperwork as Prosecution Exhibits 14 through 16. This enlistment paperwork indicated that the appellant had used marijuana prior to joining the United States Navy. This evidence of the appellant's pre-service use of drugs was properly admissible during sentencing under RCM 1001B4 as evidence in aggravation. Because the appellant did not object to the admission of this evidence during sentencing, the appellant weighed the issue and cannot demonstrate plain error. Now, based on the record at page 397, it's unclear under what subsection of RCM 1001 the trial counsel admitted the appellant's pre-service drug use. Was it admitted as a personnel record under 1001B2? Was it introduced as evidence in aggravation under 1001B4? Or was it introduced as both? The record's simply not clear. Regardless, even if the appellant's pre-service drug use was admitted as a personnel record under 1001B2, the appellant still cannot demonstrate plain error because the evidence would have still come into evidence under 1001B4 as evidence in aggravation. RCM 1001B4 allows the trial counsel to introduce into evidence any evidence which directly relates to the appellant's conviction at court-martial. In this case, the appellant's prior use of marijuana directly relates to the appellant's conviction at court-martial for the use of marijuana. How does it relate? First, it's the exact same offense, the use of marijuana. Secondly, the appellant's...
Did the trial counsel make that argument?
That it was the exact same offense, Your Honor?
That it was being introduced to show that it was the exact same offense?
He didn't specifically articulate that. His sentencing argument was only 20 lines, so he didn't articulate much.
Well,
but it's clear that...
Can we say that the evidence was admissible based upon an argument that wasn't made and a theory not offered?
Your Honor, the fact that it was the same offense shows how the pre-service misconduct was directly related under 1001B4.
So, in your view, every use of marijuana by an individual is admissible, pre-service use is admissible in a court-martial when there's a marijuana offense at stake?
No, Your Honor, that's not the government's position.
Okay. Then what is the government's position as to why this use of marijuana is admissible in this case?
The government would say that the fact that it's the same offense should factor into the calculus of whether it's admissible under 1001B4. However, the government's main contention is that the appellant's pre-service use of marijuana put the appellant's misconduct at court-martial in perspective for the members. In this case, the appellant used marijuana within 6 months of joining the Navy. When the appellant enlisted in the Navy, she was specifically told that the use of marijuana or drugs was prohibited and that essentially the Navy was giving her a chance to enlist, despite the fact that she had used marijuana in her past and letting her in on a drug waiver. Despite her knowledge that the Navy was taking a chance on her and letting her in on a drug waiver, she went and intentionally violated that policy and used marijuana again.
Well, what about the argument that we traditionally frown on, sentencing arguments that refer to service policies?
During the trial counsel's sentencing argument, the government's reading of the record is not that the trial counsel was referencing the Navy's zero tolerance policy on drugs.
You just said that this reflected the policy. I mean, that was your statement prior to my question.
The pre-service use of misconduct, Your Honor, reflects the enormity of the appellant's crimes, that she knew that the use of drugs was not allowed in the Navy, and yet she went and used drugs again. It shows the depth of the appellant's misconduct and helped define the scope of the appellant's misconduct for the members.
So it sounds like any waiver is admissible. In any drug case, any waiver would come in.
Your Honor, the government believes that this is going to be a case-by-case analysis, that there's no per se rule that's really going to work.
How would your argument that you've just made not apply to all other cases?
When the pre-service misconduct is a drug offense involving marijuana and the conviction at court-martial is for the use of marijuana, under 1001B4, the argument for the direct relationship is very strong in that case.
So why couldn't the trial counsel say she came in on a drug waiver, she knew the Navy's drug policy, and she violated it anyway? It doesn't matter whether it was marijuana or what kind of drug it was. As long as she came in under a waiver, the government's position is that's an appropriate argument. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The government would say that the argument is stronger, of course, when you have the exact same offense.
And that's regardless that the offense may have been a single experimental use when she was 13.
Those may be different facts, Your Honor. As the prior use of the drugs becomes longer in time, the case for making it directly relates to the conviction at court-martial becomes more tenuous.
And we don't know here when it was.
We do know that it was 6 months prior to her enlistment, because she notated that on her enlistment paperwork. So the argument is stronger in this case, Your Honor.
And how many, 6 months prior to, and when was this the drug offense in this case?
The drug offense in this case, Your Honor, was April 30th, 2001.
Which was how long after her enlistment?
Her enlistment was in July of 1998.
So 3 years later?
Roughly, Your Honor.
Is that relevant, how many years later? Or
again,
you're
Your
a master
Honor,
sergeant with 50 years. You get the drug waiver from when you were 17 coming in?
It's more difficult for the government to argue that the prior misconduct directly relates to the offense of court-martial the longer ago in time the prior use of drugs occurred. In this case, again, the prior use of drugs occurred only 6 months before enlistment, and the offense of court-martial only occurred 3 years after the enlistment. So the government's contention is that it more directly relates than under Your Honor's hypothetical 50 years ago.
I'm assuming that from your brief, in that you concede that it was not admissible under 1001B2, that you have no quarrel with the Navy Marine Corps Court's decision in Martin.
That's correct, Your Honor. The government would agree that the evidence of appellant's pre-service drug use under the lower court's ruling in Martin cannot come in under 1001B2.
But it can come in under B4.
Yes, sir.
Now, what are some of the other waivers? There's drug waiver. Are there other waivers for committing larceny or something like that, misdemeanors or something like that?
Your Honor, there aren't any that spring to mind right now.
If this were a case of honesty, a theft of a credit card or something, could the government say, we gave her a chance, She knew we expected people to follow our policies, and she didn't. Why isn't that directly related? It shows an issue of trust.
The government, under your hypothetical...
Someone who's trustworthy, so that should come in.
Under your hypothetical, Your Honor, it might. If we had a case where the appellant was convicted at court-martial for theft, and it could be shown that the appellant came in on a theft waiver, if something like that existed, that prior theft, which is uncharged misconduct, would probably come in under 1001b4 as evidence of an aggravation. I'm simply just not sure what other types of waivers there are besides drug waivers.
Waivers only arise where there's some regulation that says you can't be enlisted if, and then what the Navy does is saying, okay, you've done this, but we're going to waive this and allow you in. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's the government's understanding. Now, the appellant's case falls squarely within the facts and the holding of the lower court's decision in United States v. Honeycutt. In Honeycutt, the appellant was convicted of selling marijuana and cocaine at court-martial. During the sentencing portion of the trial counsel admitted evidence of the appellant's pre-service use of marijuana, very much like the facts in the case before the court today. The court below held that this prior use of marijuana was appropriate evidence in aggravation under 1001b4. The court below reasoned that the appellant's prior use of drugs help define the enormity of the appellant's crimes at court-martial for the members. Similarly, in the appellant's case before the court today, the appellant's prior use of marijuana helped define the enormity of the appellant's misconduct for the members. Now, even if this court were to conclude that it was error under RCM 1001b4 for the appellant's prior use of marijuana to be admitted during sentencing, the error was certainly not plain or obvious based on the lower court's holding in United States v. Honeycutt. Based on Honeycutt, the military judge could have reasonably concluded that it was admissible for the trial counsel to have admitted the appellant's prior use of marijuana under RCM 1001b4. The appellant also cannot demonstrate material prejudice because even without the admission of Prosecution Exhibits 14 through 16, the appellant still would have received a bad conduct discharge.
How do we know that?
Your Honor.
What was the confinement in this case?
The only adjudged sentence in this case, Your Honor, was a bad conduct discharge.
Well, that sounds like a pretty light sentence. How do we know that the judge in a case where the members in a case where you've got no confinement, no forfeitures, how do we know what they would have done as far as a punitive discharge if they didn't have this? If they didn't listen carefully to the trial counsel's argument that here we've got someone who is a repeat offender against the military, someone who, just as the trial counsel said, was given a second chance and now violated that trust of the second chance. Why isn't that a fairly powerful argument? Now, I'm assuming that would be error to come in.
Yes, Your Honor. If we go on the assumption that the appellant has demonstrated the first two prongs of plain error and move directly to the third prong, the offense of the use of drugs is very serious, obviously, in the United States military. Given the fact that the use of drugs is such a serious offense, along with looking at the appellant's conduct in this case and trying to evade her urinalysis, which was gone into during the case on the merits, even without the introduction of prosecutions and exhibits 14 through 16, it can be determined that the appellant still would have received a bad conduct discharge.
Even in a case where the members didn't think it was serious enough to warrant confinement or forfeitures?
The government would argue that a punitive discharge is the most serious offense that could be adjudged at this special court-martial, and that's exactly what the appellant got. In conclusion,
what was the enormity of the crime here other than the drug use? Was this on the flight line? Is this off-duty drug use? Is this on-duty drug use?
It was not on the flight line. She worked... In Kings Bay, Your Honor, and there's nothing to suggest she was on duty or anything like that. The enormity of the crime in this case is the fact that she had used marijuana before. She knew she was coming on a waiver into the United States Navy, and yet she intentionally violated that agreement and used marijuana again. That's where the enormity of the misconduct comes from.
Doesn't that sound like the defense's prejudice argument?
I'm not sure I follow that.
That is, the government's not conceding error, but if we did have error in this case, the enormity of the crime from the trial counsel's point of view is that we have someone who violated the trust of a second chance. If that information had not been brought before the members, that is the enlistment contract situation, the members never would have known about the second chance situation. They would have had just a one-time pop in front of them.
Yes, Your Honor. The government's strongest arguments in this case are that the pre-service drug use, the appellant cannot demonstrate plain error because the appellant cannot satisfy either the first or second prong of plain error. If this court were to conclude that the appellant has demonstrated the first two prongs, the government's strongest argument is not that the appellant can't demonstrate prejudice.
Is your strongest argument, are you conceding that you would lose if this wasn't plain error?
No, Your Honor, the government's not conceding. The government's simply saying that our strongest argument is that the appellant can demonstrate under plain error neither the first or second prongs.
The first prong is whether there was error.
Correct, Your Honor.
I thought in your brief that you acknowledged that was error.
No, Your Honor. The government's position is that the trial counsel introduced appellant's pre-service drug use under RCM 1001 generally without stating a subsection, but that the evidence comes in under 1001B4. However, and this is the point the government tried to make in their brief, if this court concludes that the trial counsel specifically introduced and admitted the evidence under 1001B2 as a personnel record, the appellant still cannot demonstrate plain error because the evidence still comes in under RCM 1001B4.
Okay. So we don't know really the extent of the military judge's ruling, but to the extent it relied upon B2, you're agreeing that it was in error. So that takes care of the first element for that portion of the opinion, whatever it was. And then the issue is whether or not it was clear and obvious. And you're in agreement that there's no inconsistency between Martin and Honeycutt.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so then, really, it seems to me the entire case goes down to whether or not it was in aggravation under B4.
The government would agree that this case turns on whether the appellant's pre-service use of drugs directly relates to his conviction at court-martial for the use of drugs.
And use of drugs at some point 3.5 years before enlistment directly relates.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Got it.
Because it defines the enormity of the offense in some manner.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the offense is a off-duty drug use, or we don't know what it is, a one-time use of drug use.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the enormity of that offense is magnified by the fact that the person had a waiver 3.5 years earlier.
That's correct, Your Honor. Your Honor, I see that my time is up. If I may conclude.
May conclude briefly.
In conclusion, the evidence of appellant's pre-service drug use was properly admissible during sentencing under RCM 1001B2. Even if this court finds that it was not admissible under RCM 1001B4, the appellant waived the issue and cannot demonstrate plain error. If there are no other questions, the government asks that this court affirm the findings of the court below.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Doesn't first the government's statement that the appellant was specifically told or specifically acknowledged that use of drugs was not allowed in the Navy. It's interesting to note that in Prosecution Exhibit 16, which is where the government relies on that statement, what the appellant actually initials is that she would be administratively processed if she used drugs again. Which is far from what happened to her actually, which was that she was sent to a court-martial, of course.
Isn't everybody notified that the military does not tolerate drug use, or is that just people who come in on waivers?
I believe
are we allowed to take notice of that?
Yes, Your Honor.
presumably anybody who popped positive knows they're violating the military drug policy, not just the people who signed waivers.
Yes, Your Honor, and I only raise the issue.
Statement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Go ahead.
I only raise the issue to note that this was an administrative processing acknowledgement. Getting to the government's statement that this reflected on the enormity of the conviction, the government's argument is circular in that sense, because it does reflect, it does build itself on the Navy policy, the zero tolerance policy, which is not allowed in a court-martial. Finally, the sentence in this case was light. It was a BCD, which indicates the material prejudice that the appellant suffered in this case. Essentially, the members bought off on the prosecution's argument and on what he was asking the members to do, and that was not give the appellant that second chance. They bought off on it and gave her that BCD and nothing else, where they could have given her something else like restriction or perhaps some confinement. To conclude, the appellant respectfully requests that this court set aside her sentence for Article 59 and set aside the BCD.
Thank you, counsel. Thank counsel for both parties for their presentation. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.